Today is Wednesday, November 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, gunmen killed 15 village defense volunteers and wounded 5 security personnel in southern Thailand. And the International Telecommunication Union reports more than half of the world's women are missing out on the benefits of the digital revolution.
Because more women than men live in remote, rural areas where internet access is limited.
Plus, a look back on the Berlin Wall, which came down 30 years ago this week. Those stories and a whole lot more are coming up next. Gunmen in insurgency racked southern Thailand killed 15 village defense volunteers and wounded 5 security personnel in what is believed to be the deadliest attack on government forces since the separatist rebellion began 15 years ago. VOA's Jeff Custer has the details.
A Thai army spokesman said bloodstained clothing found at the scene suggested that some of the attackers on 2 checkpoints in Yala province late Tuesday night also may have been wounded in the exchanges of gunfire. The spokesman added 4 of the slain officers were women and 1 was a doctor. A senior police official described what appeared to be a coordinated attack. Nails were scattered on a highway to disable vehicles entering Yala. A small explosive device was found near an electrical pole to knock out power, and several burning tires were left at a school. Thailand's volunteer forces in the south are recruited from villages and receive weapons training from the army, but no salary. They are usually issued shotguns, but often carry personal handguns and only guard their own villages rather than seek to confront the insurgents. Over 7,000 people have been killed since the insurgency erupted in 2004 in Thailand's 3 southernmost provinces, the only ones with Muslim majorities in the Buddhist-dominated country. Muslim residents have long charged that they are treated like second-class citizens, and separatist movements have been periodically active for decades. Heavy-handed crackdowns have fueled the discontent. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
House Democrats will launch a major new phase of their impeachment inquiry next week with public hearings that will feature 3 State Department officials who have testified about their concerns about President Donald Trump's dealings with Ukraine. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, who was leading the impeachment investigation, announced Wednesday that the committee will hear from top Ukraine diplomat William Taylor, career Department official George Kent, and former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch in hearings scheduled for Wednesday and Friday. Tuesday, a key U.S. diplomat, Gordon Sondland, told the impeachment investigators targeting the president that he came to believe nearly $400 million in U.S. military aid to Ukraine would not be released unless Kiev publicly stated it would launch investigations to help Trump politically. Joining us with more on the story from the White House is VOA Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, can you let us know what the White House response was to Sondland's testimony that was revised on Tuesday?
Right. Steve, they definitely have a bit of a different reading on all of this than most of the media. Stephanie Grisham, the White House press secretary, did put out a statement saying that both the transcripts show, in her words, there is even less evidence for this illegitimate impeachment sham than previously thought. She points to a statement by the U.S. ambassador to the European Union stating that he did not know and still does not know when, why, or by whom the aid was suspended. And Grisham goes on to say that no amount of salacious media-biased headlines, which she says are clearly designed to influence the narrative, change the fact that the president has done nothing wrong.
Has there been any updates as to what the White House strategy is going to be as these inquiries move forward? There were, you know, a few people who are scheduled to testify today. They did not respond to those subpoenas. You have David Hale, who is expected to give testimony today. But, you know, besides ignoring the subpoenas, have they come out with what they plan to do now that the House floor has taken place to move forward with a formal inquiry?
Not really. The public strategy has been what President Trump has been echoing in his tweets, quote, read the transcript. And what we have seen coming from Capitol Hill among the Republicans in light of the reports that basically Sondland's changed testimony confirms a quid pro quo, is that even if there was, this is not something to impeach the president on. The key really is to, despite what may be said on Capitol Hill by Republicans or even statements that the White House puts out, is to pay very close attention to what the president is saying and tweeting. And the president will have an opportunity to engage with reporters later Wednesday afternoon, and we may find out what his latest articulations of all this are.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Steve.
Iraqi protesters stormed a fourth bridge Wednesday in central Baghdad, where security forces pushed them back with batons and tear gas, wounding dozens after two anti-government demonstrators were killed in overnight clashes in the city of Karbala. The military called on the protesters to stop blocking roads and ports, saying that it had cost Iraq $6 billion and it vowed to arrest those responsible. Tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets in recent weeks in the capital and across the Shiite south to demand sweeping political change. The protesters complain of widespread corruption, a lack of job opportunities, and poor basic services, including regular power cuts despite Iraq's vast oil reserves. An attacker has stabbed three visitors at a popular Jordanian tourist site. AP correspondent Charles Deledesma reports.
Jordanian officials say the attacker knifed a number of tourists and their tour guide at the ancient city of Jerash, a popular archaeological site in northern Jordan. The country's public security directorate says the attacker also stabbed a policeman who tried to stop him. The wounded were taken to a hospital and the attacker arrested. A national newspaper reports the tourists were Mexican and suffered serious wounds. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 1977, NASA launched two Voyager spacecraft on a deep space mission. The original mission was to explore the solar system's outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Once their original mission ended, the two spacecraft continued traveling toward the edge of the solar system, albeit in two separate directions. In August 2012, Voyager 1 became the first human-made vehicle to exit our solar system and enter interstellar space. Voyager 2 did the same in November 2018. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory announced the release of five new studies that provide an understanding of the transition Voyager 2 made as it left the solar system and crossed over into interstellar space. Authors of the individual studies used data gathered by each of Voyager 2's five operating science instruments. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Mexican President Andres Obrador has rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's call to wage war on organized crime in his country. Trump offered U.S. help in an effort to wipe out drug cartels in Mexico in response to a massacre of nine U.S. family members on a road trip in northern Mexico. The Mexican president said Mexico would act with independence and sovereignty in pursuing the criminals behind the attack, but rejected the idea of going after them with arms. VOA's Zlatissa Hoek reports the increasingly aggressive behavior of the Mexican drug lords raises questions about who controls the country.
A burnt-out vehicle was found by the side of a road with remains of some of the victims. Three women and their 14 children were traveling in a convoy between the Mexican states of Sonora and Chihuahua when they were attacked by suspected drug cartel gunmen. Trump told Mexico's President Andrés Obrador in a tweet that the cartels have become too powerful and it was time for Mexico to wage war on them with U.S. help. Obrador responded that gunning down gang members would not solve the problem.
Of course, we didn't want this to happen, but we do not think that riddling them with bullets, slaughtering, using force, blood and fire will solve the problem.
Mexico has long battled organized crime, and as gangs became more powerful than the local police, the government deployed military troops to handle them. Despite the effort, killings by cartels have increased. Mexico has registered nearly a quarter million homicides in the last 12 years, many linked to wars between rival drug cartels. Mexico's interior minister said the massacred U.S. family may have fallen victim to a turf war between two groups.
The convoy, composed of two suburban vans, may have been confused for criminal gangs that fight for control in the region.
Powerful drug lords are believed to have divided Mexico into areas of control, and there are allegations of collusion between local police and gangs. The country's central government appears to be no match to these entrenched and ever more powerful armed groups. U.S. Senator Mitt Romney, a rare Republican who sometimes criticizes Trump, said Tuesday the president is right to demand action against Mexican criminal groups near the U.S. border.
We have a good relationship with Mexico, and yet what's happening along the border with regards to these cartels and the increasing level of violence is a real concern to us and I think to the Mexican government and how to deal with them. This has been something that Mexico's been working on for a long, long time, and there's still a problem, and it's getting worse. And so the president says, look, let's get serious about it, and has indicated that he'd be willing to help, and I think that's the right sentiment.
Mexico's president said he wants to talk to Trump about cooperation in the fight against organized crime, but also preserve Mexico's sovereignty. Zlatica Ho, VOA News, Washington.
The International Telecommunications Union reports more than half of the world's women are missing out on the benefits of the digital revolution because they lack access to the Internet. Lisa Schlein has that story.
New data find 52% of the total global female population is not using the Internet, compared to 42% of all men. The International Telecommunication Union reports a widening digital gender gap exists in every region of the world except in the Americas. While more than 4 billion people currently are using the Internet, the ITU estimates 3.6 billion remain offline, mostly in the least developed countries. The report finds Europe is the region with the highest Internet use of 82.5%, while Africa is the region with the lowest usage, with just slightly more than 28%. The report says the digital gender gap is increasing in the developing world because more women than men live in remote, rural areas where Internet access is limited. It says other barriers to usage includes rural women's lack of access to education and their poverty, which makes the Internet and mobile phones unaffordable. The acting head of statistics at the ITU, Susan Telscher, tells VOA that women's exclusion from an increasingly digital world has major implications.
They don't have access to any of the information that is available on the Internet. They don't have access to the many, many applications that are available now through smartphones, which can help them in their daily lives, in communication, in doing their daily activities, in having access to education, to health, to government services.
The ITU notes Internet use in developed countries is nearing saturation levels, with close to 87% of individuals online. It says measures must be enacted to achieve a similar result in developing countries. The UN agency says the cost of broadband must be lowered to make services more affordable. It says innovative policies have to be introduced for regulators to finance infrastructure to enable people in remote, rural, and mountainous areas to become connected. The agency also says Internet content should be in local languages so people can get the information and education available on the World Wide Web. Agency officials say governments, especially in developing countries, must enact measures to build up the digital skills of their populations. This will help them gain maximum usage and benefit from what the digital world has to offer. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson argued Wednesday that voting for the Conservatives was the only way to end the delays over Brexit, as he officially launched an election campaign already marred by gaffes and the resignation of a cabinet minister. Speaking outside his number 10 Downing Street office on the first official day of Britain's five-week election campaign, Johnson said the political impasse over Britain's departure from the European Union made him want to chew his own tie in frustration.
We can leave the EU as one UK, whole and entire and perfect, as we promised. And so it's been frankly mind-boggling in the last few weeks to see how Parliament first voted to approve this deal and then voted for delay. And I'm afraid that it is clear that if Parliament had its way, then this country would not be leaving even on January the 31st. And that, of course, is bad for democracy. It's disastrous for trust in politics. Why should MPs decide that they can cancel the result of a referendum?
Johnson also slammed his main rival Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, comparing him to former Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, and erroneously claimed that he had sided with Russian President Vladimir Putin over a nerve agent attack on British territory. All 650 seats in the House of Commons are up for grabs in the December 12th election, which is coming more than 2 years early. Some 46 million British voters are eligible to take part in the country's first December vote in 96 years. On Monday, the New York Times reported that 71 medical institutions are now investigating some 180 cases involving potential theft of intellectual properties. According to that report, almost all of those under investigation are of Chinese descent. VOA Asia's Ira Melman got in touch with Dr. Ross McKinney, Chief Scientific Officer at the Association of American Medical Colleges.
Well, it sounds like a lot of people, but when you actually then think about the number of Chinese researchers or researchers of Southeast Asian descent in the United States at our schools of medicine and who are funded by the NIH, there are about 6,000 funded investigators of Asian background that the NIH funds. So the 180 sounds like a lot, but in fact, it's a pretty small proportion of the overall population of Chinese scientists or scientists of Asian descent.
Is it worrisome?
It is worrisome, and what makes it worrisome is because the collaboration between the U.S. and citizens from China who have come to work in our laboratories, who have come to work with our universities, who become collaborators, has been a really strong and rich one. And so when you start to break down the trust, it may make that very rich and very powerful collaboration more of a problem. And that's sad. I mean, we really don't want to see that because of how important these collaborations have been.
Does this threaten all of this? Does this threaten this open exchange of medical information between the U.S. and China?
It raises concerns because there are certain ground rules you expect people in science to follow. You expect people to respect that somebody who has an idea will get to develop their own idea. And once it's developed enough, you can publish it.
How was all this discovered?
It was discovered originally, as best I can tell, at MD Anderson, which is a cancer center in Texas. And they had a case where somebody was sending things to China, PDFs of grant applications, and then started to pursue and discovered that there was a program in China called the Thousand Talents Program that was recruiting scientists. And when the scientists chose not to be recruited to China, was instead funding them to do work in China while remaining on faculty in the U.S. And so that's where the problem began and from where it was uncovered.
Is the U.S. government involved in these investigations?
The U.S. and government is at the core of these investigations. While institutions are asked to do an evaluation, the FBI is engaged and the NIH is involved and is aware of or are prompted most of those 180 investigations.
There are those, as you know, who are warning that these Chinese and Chinese-American academics are now feeling at risk, including, of course, those who are not part of this situation, mm-hmm. and this crackdown will stop or stem the flow of researchers from China to the United States. Others are going as far as saying that it's racist. How do you react to that?
I think that it has had a chilling effect, and it is very sad because the issue has not been with the Chinese people. The issue has been with the Chinese government, which was doing this in a systematic way. There are a very high proportion of graduate students in the U.S., in the biomedical sciences, who are Chinese by background or citizenship. A lot of our postdocs, people who are continuing to learn new techniques and develop new tools after finishing their PhD, are also of Chinese national descent. And it's been a very rich collaboration. This, unfortunately, makes people suspicious and will make it less appealing to come to the U.S. And that's particularly sad because of how beneficial this relationship has been for decades.
And that was Dr. Ross McKinney, Chief Scientific Officer of the Association of American Medical Colleges, speaking with my VOA Asia colleague, Ira Melman. Former U.S. Secretary of State James Baker says the greatest threat to democracy today is the rise of authoritarianism. Secretary Baker spoke to VOA on the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, a moment in history in which he played a pivotal role. VOA's Vivian Chakwakin has more.
The fall of the Berlin Wall signaled the beginning of a momentous change in the world, said former U.S. Secretary of State James Baker in an interview with VOA.
The 40 years of the Cold War were coming to an end, and the fall of the wall symbolized the beginning of that end.
Some call the fall of the wall an accident of history.
Well, it wasn't a surprise. I can tell you that none of us at the time expected the implosion of the Soviet Union, the end of the Soviet Union. The fall of the wall really was not predicted to happen when it did.
He said VOA played an important role in galvanizing public support for democracy.
We knew there were demonstrations for freedom occurring all across the Warsaw Pact countries, in large part, I might add, because of the actions and efforts of the Voice of America. And the fact that we were getting our message across and into those countries.
But the last 30 years did not turn out the way Secretary Baker and key players of that time, President George H.W. Bush, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, Germany's Helmut Kohl, among others, may have hoped. According to Baker, the post-Cold War democratic order is under threat.
Well, some of the threats to democracy are a rise of authoritarianism in some of the former Warsaw Pact countries. It's occurring in Russia for sure, and it's occurring as well in some areas in other parts of the world. That system doesn't work.
He said the only way to address this challenge and the democratic backsliding we see today, such as in Poland and Hungary, is to do what we did so successfully during the Cold War.
And that is be resolute in our support of freedom, democracy, and free markets. That's how we won the Cold War.
Looking back, he reflected that if the West had done more to urge Russia to commit to free markets and democracy, we may be in a different position today.
There is a strong yearning for freedom on the part of peoples everywhere in the world. And when authoritarians come to power and try and shut off that freedom or eliminate that freedom, there's going to be resistance. That's why we won the Cold War. That's why our paradigm of democracy and free markets is the most successful one.
Baker said we must be steadfast in our resolve that our principles and values are the principles and values that free people around the world seek to maintain and subscribe to.
We are, quite frankly, in my view, in another Cold War. Almost every bit as cold as the one before.
According to Secretary Baker, the only way to win it is the way we won the first one. Vivian Chakarian, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha, engineer Thomas Blondet, and managing editor Paul Alexander, thank you very much for joining us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.